You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How are you guys?
Good. Fair.
Are you doing
quite
all right?
Kara, you missed last week just because you didn't have internet.
Yeah. Internets were not set up in my new house yet.
And it was literally set up seconds ago.
That was actually not internet that was set up seconds ago. That was my electricians have been here all day setting up the car charger, installing fans, fixing a couple of light switches, and they promised they would be done on time to podcast, and they were dragging their heels. But I finally got them out of the house.
By Craggy?
Yeah.
Yeah, but wait, now we should be celebrating because Kara's internet is like ridiculous. It's so ridiculous, we have to say it's ridiculi. It's a ridiculi.
It's redonkulous.
It's a,
is that a little like 2005?
473 megs down.
Ooh.
473. I'm at 350. I'm at 350 right now.
But your upload speed's better than mine. I'm at 24 up right now.
I'm usually around 30, 35 upload.
Yeah, that's high. I've never had that good of an upload speed. But this is also the highest download speed I've ever had in my life. It's like, congratulations, your internet speed is super fast. You can download 4K porn.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have 4K streaming now. Mm. You know, I have a 4K TV, so and just like regular like Roku and all that stuff, they do 4K streaming now. So you really do need to download.
Yeah.
But like we do upload, right? We do streaming too. For this, like my house is my studio, and even though I have the business class internet connection, still the upload's only like 35.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's so asymmetrical, and I'm telling the guy, all right, I get it, I understand. Why, for residential users, they're basically downloading and they don't need that much upload. What are they sending email? But, I'm a business. What do you think businesses are doing these days? We are streaming to the internet. We need upload, but they don't even offer it as an option.
Mm-mm.
Like symmetrical up and down.
You pay for download. Like any package that's offered is always based on the download speed. They just ignore the upload speed altogether.
Yeah. It's just neglect.
Weird.
You know, every now and then I check with my cable company just to see like what are you offering? And usually I could like get more for less. Like I actually got almost doubled my internet connection and I'm paying less every month just because the packages get better over time. But
really?
I was actually paying less than I was, and I have a pretty significant upgrade. But I think, all right, now maybe I'll be able to get some decent upload because it's a business class and people do streaming and stuff like that. But nope, it's still ridiculously asymmetrical.
What would the quality be for your typical user if, say, everyone had access to 200 upload speed?
Well, but that's the thing.
Would that clog everybody up?
You just wouldn't use it. That's for most people just wouldn't use it. What do most people upload to the internet? Their email, you know, or their
photos.
They're uploading photos or something like that. Yeah, it's not that much. If you're doing online backup, then upload is huge too. That's also another service. If you're backing up your stuff online, you might be putting a terabyte up there. Upload is huge. I upload the show every week, right? And it used to take a long time. You know, now it takes a lot less time. Sometimes I forget, like if I'm on the road, like I'm in a hotel somewhere, uploading the show.
Oh
and
my gosh,
I get
horrible.
I upload it. It's like 20 seconds. The show is up. But then if I forget, like I have to leave 20 minutes or 30 minutes to upload the show if I'm not at home. You know,
brutal.
Yeah. It does make a huge difference.
I hate that.
Yeah,
I don't understand why you can't just have like an a la carte service. Like, hey, I want to have 100 up and 200 down. Like they never offer you 100 up. And that's the part I don't understand. It seems like it's rigid. Like they're giving you such a small upload because they know most people don't use it. And I don't think that your internet connection is like saying, hey, the person isn't using upload right now, so I'll go move that over to download bandwidth. I think it's kind of persistent. It's my guess.
Come on, Jay. It's a system of tubes, okay? That's all you need to know.
The intertubes.
So I'm going to do a 5 to 10 year segment this week to start us off.
Very cool.
This one is just exactly 5 years ago, 2014, and it's not going to seem like it was that long ago, but it was 5 years. We first talked about solar freaking highways.
No way.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Solar roads. That was 2014. So there's a pretty significant update on this. I know we have talked about it since, but so there's now three experimental installations of solar roadways in the world. So we actually have some real world data. And what do you guys think? What do you think the experience has been so far?
I know all about it.
Yeah. It's crap. All right. So there a 1 kilometer road installed in France, and the experience with that has been completely horrible. So first of all, it was noisy. They actually had to lower the speed limit on the road because the surface just made a lot more noise than a conventional surface.
Interesting.
Okay. But that's not the worst of it, right?
No, that's not the worst of it. So the worst of it is that it produced half the electricity that was promised. Mm-hmm. The original aim was 790 kilowatt hours per day, each day, which would illuminate between, say, 3,000 and 5,000 people, they said population.
Mm-hmm.
But they only hit, it was only 50% on installation and declined by another 50% after Yikes. A year. So 25% of the projected energy output. So the electricity production decreases rapidly with age. Plus, they weathered horribly. The solar panels would come up, and if they got loose, then they would break. It would break the circuit. Just dry leaves or wet leaves on it would cover the surface. All the things that we feared, the surface would not weather well, and that the solar panels in the road would not survive long, is true. So essentially, the analysis was that it was not cost effective. The cost, mm-hmm. the amount of electricity getting out of it was not worth the installation cost and would not be worth the maintenance cost. So that was considered an abject failure. There was a second one
he
installed.
He says with pride.
Yeah, there was a second one installed in Idaho in the U.S. This has also been judged a complete failure. So wow. of 25 of the 30 panels installed in this prototype road were broken.
Couldn't even get it down safely.
That's the part that really bothered me when I read that. I was like, wow, they can't even make these things, let alone like get them to the job site and install them. They just don't work no matter how you look at
it. Actually, I was like 18 were broken on installation, and 25 were broken after the first week.
A quarter of these tiles are broken.
I've got a job to do. It was plagued by draining issues, poor manufacturing controls, fundamental design flaws.
Yikes.
So that was bad. Now, you might say that this was a problem of execution and not of concept.
You might trap it.
You might, but this is the data that we have. Two attempts at installing a solar road, and they were plagued by all the problems that the skeptics said that they would be. It's not a good idea to put solar panels on a road because they're not oriented to the sun. They have to withstand road traffic, including trucks and tractors and stuff. Their skid marks and all the usual stuff that happens is going to degrade the surface, so their efficiency is going to go down. It's not the place that you want to install solar panels. However, there was a third experience that actually turned out fairly well. But this was not a solar road, although the company that installed it was Solar Road, ironically. It was a solar bike path.
Yeah.
This was in Belgium. Yeah, so they installed a solar bike path, and it actually produced more electricity than they initially anticipated, up to 93 kilowatt hours per square meter. However, the efficiency dropped, to the 70s, which was the original sort of projection. So it's basically producing as much energy as projected. So that's not too bad. And so that amount of electricity, you would need about 130 square meters to power a typical home. A typical home uses about 10,000 kilowatt hours per year. That's like, if your driveway were paved with these things, you could probably power, a huge chunk of your home with it, depending on how big your driveway was. But the difference here was that it was only bicycles and foot traffic, right? It was people walking on it and bicycle, no cars.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that's the smart thing. That's what people need to do if they want to make a solar
path. But why? We don't need to be putting those on the ground like that. I mean, you know, these objects don't need to be worthy of having people walk on them and all that. Like, there's better places.
I think the difference is that, yeah, like, we have solar farms, right? We have solar farms in places, but then it's like, that's all we can use that land for. Is these kind of or these diagonal solar panels. Some of them shift with the sun, some of them don't. You know, they're oriented so they capture the most sun. But, you know, I think that the Musk, Tesla, you know, roof tiles is a smart idea.
Yeah.
Sure, they're not the most efficient because they're not all facing the right way, but they are beautiful and aesthetics matter to people. You know, people don't want always to have spent all this money having a gorgeous roof and then have these like big honking solar panels on top of it.
I think they look cool.
Yeah, and I do too personally, but some people don't, you know what I mean? And so I think the roof tiles were kind of a genius thing. It's like form meets function. And I think that's what these bike paths are about. How can we put them in urban areas? How can we get the energy right where it needs to be done?
Yeah, I agree. And they are actually developing the technology, like the second generation panels that they developed. So first of all, they went from rigid panels to flexible panels. They went right, but the flexible ones were less efficient, but they wore much better. And then they were able to improve the top surface so that they degraded less over time. So they are actually incrementing the technology. They're developing this bike path solar panel technology, and it's getting pretty good. So
traction.
Yeah. So I think that we should look at this like, you know, and Jay, you're going to be talking next about wind turbines, but the idea here is that we shouldn't, there is no one energy solution, right? It's not like this is the way we should be making our energy. It's we should be picking the low hanging fruit of every type of carbon free energy. We should be putting solar panels where they make sense. We should be building wind turbines where they make sense, having, you know, hydroelectric where it makes the most sense, geothermal where it makes the most sense,
nuclear where
it makes the most sense, everything. And we should pick the low hanging fruit of each type of low carbon or zero carbon energy. And, you know, for solar, I just, even the bike path, it's not the lowest hanging fruit for solar, right? I think, you know, and once we put solar panels on all the roofs and, you know, in the places where they will be the most cost effective and most energy effective and efficient to put them, and then if we're still looking to cram some more solar panels someplace and we have the option, and as you say, Kara, of like putting it in a parking lot or in a park, on a bike path or a footpath or whatever, and that will, you know, serve a purpose. Sure, okay, if it makes economic sense, that's fine. But there's no particular reason to do this when there are other better options, right? Mm.
That's a good point, Steve. Yeah, I mean, bottom line is that if they had the technology, right, if they put these tiles in on the road and they worked great, we'd use them. They don't work.
So stop pushing. Yeah, exactly. It's like, let's not do another trial solar roadway.
Yeah, I mean, maybe another decade or so.
Glad they tried, but.
What's really annoying, though, is that when this first came out, if you just really looked at it objectively, it was kind of obvious that that you were going to be having these problems, you know, and they put so much effort and money into it when it's like, you know, let's just be more efficient and focus on things, the low hanging fruit, because we are not ready for solar roadways if we ever will be.
Yeah. But I have no problem with them developing the technology because you never know how it might be used. For example, one thing I say is I would love it if my driveway would melt all the snow and ice that collects on it by itself. So if you could put in, like, if you could make my driveway into a solar pavement, right? And put some batteries underneath there, and then it could light up at night, or it could melt the snow and ice in the winter. If it gets to the point where that's actually a reasonably cost effective option, fine. If it also then paid for itself by giving me some free electricity, okay.
Still makes more sense to have just solar panels.
Yeah.
And then a heated driveway.
Yeah.
Right. That may make more sense. You're right.
Yeah.
So, but whatever. But you have to consider all the options. It depends on, like, how much sun does your driveway get versus how much your roof gets? How are they oriented? Or maybe your house is, you have solar panels on your roof and it's only giving you 80% of your electricity and the driveway can give you another 20%, or maybe you're going to get that second all electric car and your electricity needs go up even further. You really want to maximize the solar energy you're producing, but you're out of space. Well, you have your driveway sitting there, whatever. There's going to be niche applications where it makes sense, but it's not going to transform the way we generate our electricity.
Yeah, let's say you wanted to wear solar panels on your face, Kara.
Yeah, you
know, like in the future,
very important to me.
We might
solar
need
solar earrings, solar nose rings. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How about solar paint?
Yeah.
Well, we're far away from that, but I know.
Smart material.
All right. Well, Jay, why don't you start us off with the news items by giving us an update on wind turbines?
So we got a theme going on here. Is that it?
Well, it just kind of happened that way. You know, that the solar roadway thing came up, and I told Steve I wanted to talk about some cool information that came out recently about wind farms. But check this out. So the U.S. Department of Energy had released a report that they put together where they quantify how did wind power do in 2018. Like, let's talk about the stats. So there's a few things I wanted to quickly summarize and clarify before I get into the math of how wind power did in 2018. So a gigawatt equals a billion watts, and a watt is a unit of power over time, if you want to think of it that way. So as an example, you could say that a solar farm is producing a certain number of gigawatts per hour, right? So if you say this solar farm makes 1 gigawatt per hour, that means that it's producing that amount of energy every hour, or at least the energy is available during that hour. So here's some interesting facts I found. So 1 gigawatt for 1 gigawatt hour can give electricity or supply electricity to 300,000 to 700,000 homes in the United States. I've read both of those numbers. So I think it's a variable depending on time of year, you know, air conditioning is being used and things like that.
Size of the home. Yeah.
Exactly. 44% of the power in the United States comes from coal. 34% of the U.S. power production comes from what?
Nuclear.
Right? Comes from power plants, those types of power plants. Thank you for saying that word for me, Steve. A typical coal-powered power plant produces 547 megawatt hours of power at full capacity. Think about that. 1 gigawatt equals 3.41 billion British thermal units for our friends that use that as a measurement. So in order to produce 1 gigawatt hour of power, you need 3.125 million photovoltaic panels, which are solar panels.
Okay.
And then, surprisingly, you need 412 utility scale wind turbines.
Like, I have something like 20 panels on my house, you know?
Yep.
So that's like how much it would take to power one home. Whereas one wind turbine is powering, what, hundreds of homes?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they produce an extraordinarily larger amount of, just a huge amount of energy. So wind supplies only 6.5% of the U.S.'s total electricity in 2018, with an installed capacity close to 100 gigawatts. Germany is getting 20% of its power from wind. Denmark is over 40. Good job, Denmark.
Mm-hmm. Well, they already had all those windmills and place.
That's correct. Well, they already have the experience, right? So the key factor here is that 30%, so if you're deriving 30% of your energy, your electricity from renewables, not just wind, but from renewables, this becomes a point where you will start to have problems with today's grids. So the fact that Denmark is pulling 40% from renewables is amazing, because their grid is actually keeping up with it. Now, what are we talking about here? Why would a grid have a problem with over 30%? It's because it's intermittent power. So if, you know, you're getting like 10-20% from an intermittent power source, the other power sources that are consistent, like coal and gas, can make up the balance, right? Make up the valleys. But if you're getting like over 30%, you know, the modern grids just don't have the ability to truly, you know, keep the power flowing, except of course if you're in Denmark. I'd really like to know how well it's working in Denmark, but it is a testament that we're hitting a technological ceiling on our current grid, and we need to update, you know, every grid in the planet needs to be updated. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
it's not just that, Jay, but when you push the penetration of renewables, intermittent sources like solar and wind, past 30-40%, you have to produce more and more overcapacity. Meaning you need more capacity than you need at any one moment, which means that those wind turbines and those solar panels are going to be turned off when you're not using them, because you need them there for extra capacity. But then Yeah. They're not going to be running all the time.
I have no problem with that. You know, like, you know, that's the point. If we can do that, if we can overbuild our need by, say, hey, we're going to build, you know, 30 or 40% extra of all these renewable sources, and we can turn them on per need. That's fine with me. You know, that downtime.
Yeah, it's not a matter of being fine. It's that it gets less and less cost effective. So the cost effectiveness, and I know that's where you're heading with this news item about the cost effectiveness of wind turbines. Sure, at 6% penetration, absolutely, because they're going to be on 98% of the time. At 40% penetration, they're a lot less cost effective because they're not going to be on 98% of the time. They're going to be on 80% or 60% of the
time. That's why we need batteries. That's why we need
exactly
convenient
exactly.
ways to store this energy.
We need grid storage. We need grid storage.
The world is working on it. It's the hugest industry. You know, I'm not worried about it. I've always been a fan of Kara. Did we talk about this? I remember talking to you. I think about this where they spin up a super heavy disc, like a porcelain disc or a dense metal disc in a vacuum. So during the day, your house is collecting data. Collecting energy. You're not using all of it. You're not even home during the day. You're at work. You're not using all this energy. So your house could just be filling up. What would you call that? A dry battery? It's a physical battery. It's not like it's a battery that has to do more with inertia than it has to do with electrons.
It's an inertia battery, yeah.
Jay, that's really cool. But I think a common fear that people have with that is imagine you've got this thing in your house. You've got this thing, like say in the basement, buried under the basement or wherever they would be. You've got this heavy, dense, super fast spinning thing. I mean, we're talking thousands and tens of thousands of revolutions per second. It needs to be spinning really, really fast. If there's an accident, it's catastrophic because you've got this thing going crazy, spinning.
That's just it.
Bury it in like a big steel box or something.
You would have to do something like that, which then raises the price. But I think people just have a fear of that, and it's cool. But what about other things that are like you have a special type of salt that you can heat and that will stay molten it's fairly efficient where you're not losing a lot of heat. So you're storing heat that you can then turn into electricity and like this vat of molten salt type of thing. I mean, that's a viable.
Sure. Or we did that thing. Remember the tower? It built, you know.
Oh, that was cool.
It builds like a stone
pulleys,
tower.
Yeah.
And then, it lets the stones down when it wants the energy and it can change on a dime. Like it can go from storage to, input from output.
That was one of the cooler contraptions we've ever seen.
We talked about the fact that the most efficient grid storage in terms of total turnaround time is pumped hydro.
Yeah, hydro. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
And after that, pretty much is batteries. You know, the batteries are still, batteries are only getting better. So all of these exotic things are fine, but they're not as efficient as just our current battery technology, let alone where we're going to be in 5, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, there's no eureka out there waiting to be discovered.
It's incremental advances. We need our batteries to be cheaper and out of more abundant material.
Yeah, like not dangerous for the environment as well.
Yeah.
So I got a few more interesting pieces of information here. So in 2018, 7.6 gigawatts of new wind capacity was added to the U.S. grid.
Good.
The cost of a wind plant is now equal to or less than natural gas. Coal and gas costs of operation are likely to stay the same, right? Because we're not going to be, you know, having massive leaps in technology for coal and gas, you know, collection and burning and all that.
They're mature technologies. They're not going anywhere.
That's right. But wind and solar, man, they're becoming more efficient every year dramatically. And they so what's happening is we're finding that wind power is dropping overall in price while we have advances in the technology, meaning that it's less to build and install and run, and the technology is collecting more energy, right? As we advance in the technology. So here's a cool example. So in 2008, all turbines in the United States were smaller than 100 meters, right? We're talking about the fan blades themselves. By 2018, 99% were over 100 meters, averaging 116 meters. So along with that, the generators were producing more electricity, not just because the fan blades were bigger, but because the generators themselves got better. So we've seen a 5% increase in power output from 2017 technology just to 2018 technology. That's in 1 year, a 5% increase. Just
20 years, we'll have 100%. It doesn't quite work that way.
In fact, the latest technology can generate power even on lighter wind days. If you took a wind turbine from 15 years ago, it would stop moving in a certain speed, right? So with airspeed. today, because of new materials and everything is working better, the technology is better, we can be pulling power from places that were just not useful, you know, a decade ago. And that's only going to, you know, increase as we, as this technology matures. You know, you never know, like the amount of improvement we're going to get, but it's going to be at least 5%. You know, it's going to be at least, you know, going up in that direction. As Magneto said to Charles Xavier, the future is ours, Charles, right? He's talking about mutants. Well, the future is renewable without a doubt.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely good that it's cheaper now to put in a wind turbine than to build even a natural gas, you know, powered plant, which natural gas has been, the price has been plummeting because of fracking,
yep.
Which is actually the U.S.'s total CO2 output decreased a little bit. It's mainly because of replacing coal with natural gas.
There you go.
But hopefully
renewables
will start coming into their own and drive the CO2 production down further. Unless, of course, we retire and nuclear plants and replace them with coal-fired plants.
Yep. Yeah.
And, right. Well,
right now, we have 2 more years for people to get government support in the United States to put, you know, for putting in renewable energy.
Yeah.
And that's going to go away. I don't know if they're going to do something
else
at that point.
They might extend it, yeah. But eventually, you know, the efficiency of scale will be such that they'll be cost-effective on their own. So that's really the purpose of subsidies, is just get over that hump, you know, to where the economics favor doing those. So we're actually getting there with wind and solar. So I don't know, they might not renew it just because it's not necessary anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's actually cost effective to put in wind and solar. All right, Kara, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is the FDA warning people not to drink industrial strength bleach?
I mean, it's not a good idea, is it?
No.
But why now?
Why do they have to warn people not to do this?
Don't drink gasoline.
And maybe instead you should ask, why have they had to do it twice?
I think they've done it more than twice.
Or more than twice, yeah. But one FDA letter, I guess you call it, a statement, mm-hmm. that was put out in 2010. Now they've had to do another one in 2019, all about something called Miracle Mineral Solution.
Mm.
Have you guys heard of Miracle Mineral Solution?
Absolutely. We've talked about it on the show before.
There you go. It's also been marketed as Master Mineral Supplement, Water Purification Solution, Chlorine Dioxide Protocol, and MMS, which is short for Miracle Mineral Solution.
Yeah.
There's also Master Mineral Solution. They changed the names a little bit. So the FDA put out this statement and did not name any names. Luckily, our own Stephen Novella did name names in his write-up of the piece. But in the FDA statement, they write about quote-unquote online treatments that are marketed towards autism.
Sure.
Cancer.
Oh boy.
HIV and AIDS, hepatitis, flu, and other conditions. These master or miracle mineral solutions, let's just call them MMSs. These MMSs are a solution of sodium chloride and water. And then there's either instructions for people to add citric acid in the form of like lemon juice or lime juice, or sometimes they even have a little packet of like citric acid solution that you're meant to add to the sodium chloride. Well, what happens when you add citric acid to sodium chloride? You make bleach.
Chlorine dioxide. Thank you very much.
And then you're supposed to drink it because, as they say, oh, it's an antimicrobial and an antiviral and an antibacterial. Well, yeah.
And anti-life, like, too. You're scrubbing your floor, your hospital, you know, surfaces, maybe.
Yeah,
it's an anti-human, too.
Exactly.
It's anti-human. Yeah,
it's anti-human. You're right.
Oh, my God.
You're both right. It's anti-life. It's anti-human. It kills things. And so you're right.
Gosh.
This is meant for surfaces. It's not meant for human consumption. And the FDA has had to come out and say, this is false. This is dangerous. And here's the grossest part of this. And then we'll get into like the huckster that that Steve, you wrote about on Science-Based Medicine. Jim Humble. Looks like a great guy. Here's the grossest part. They label these solutions, these miracle mineral solutions, and say, you know, it's working because it causes you to vomit.
Mm-hmm.
So then
that's how
people,
you know it's working. Yeah.
Yeah. So then people.
My weight loss plan does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how you know a knife is working when you bleed.
Yeah.
You know it's working when you vomit makes it so that people who actually are starting to get the early stages of this type of sickness that can kill you, whether it's from severe dehydration, from vomiting and diarrhea, or from like acute liver failure, which is what happens sometimes. These things are going to cause you to vomit and you might not seek help right away because you actually think that this is the intended outcome of your treatment. That's horrible. That's so dangerous. And so, of course, this has killed people, lots of people. The New York Times reported that there are at least 7 deaths of people where there's a direct linkage to Miracle Mineral Solution, which means that they were able to say conclusively that somebody drank this specific product and died. There have been at least 20 people affected by it, but the deaths were 2 in 2018, 1 in 2017, 1 in 2014, 2013, 2011, and 2009. So this has been happening over and over. They also went to the Poison Control Center and figured out annual reports of exposure to non-household bleach in their attempt to try and figure out like other types of exposure. And they found 226 cases in 2017, 276 cases in 2016. But then, of course, they interviewed a medical toxicologist who works at the National Capital Poison Center in Washington, D.C. And this toxicologist was basically saying, listen, people don't call poison control always. So these numbers are like massively underreported.
Underreported. Oh,
yeah. Like A, they're not going to call because they think it's working because it says you should be vomiting. B, once they realize that they drank bleach because basically their pastor told them to, and we'll get to that in a second, they're embarrassed. And so they don't call.
It's even worse than that because what these hucksters do, Kara, is they'll go to foreign countries as well and set up clinics, they call it there. They will treat people, so mm-hmm. they call it, in places like Haiti, the Dominican Republic, you know, Mexico,
where they desperately need medical care.
Right, people are even more desperate, and who knows what kind of record keeping they do on this, on the casualties and deaths due to this product in those countries. We have
especially
no
post-crisis
idea
like a place
no
like
idea
Haiti
how,
after
how
hurricane.
Extensive the damage is, right?
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible. And as Steve, you wrote in your Science-Based Medicine article where you talked about Jim Humble. It says Jim Humble, bleach salesman.
Bleach salesman.
That's amazing. That's what you wrote under the picture. that he has, run off to Mexico.
Yep.
To basically escape regulation, to escape FDA authority, who knows? The New York Times wrote about a guy from Spokane, Washington, named Daniel Smith, who was found guilty by a federal jury for selling like these miracle cures. But I don't know like what his sentencing was. I just know that he was found guilty. But who knows? Okay, and all the jury convicted him of 1 count of conspiracy to commit multiple crimes, 3 counts of introducing misbranded drugs into interstate commerce with intent to defraud or mislead, and 1 count of fraudulently smuggling merchandise into the United States. They found him not guilty on 1 of the 4 misbranded drug counts. He faces a statutory maximum of 34 years. But who knows what the minimum sentence that he's going to end up with is. Unfortunately, our old friend here, Jim Humble, and maybe Steve, you can fill in some of the details on this. He happens to run a church.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And his
Genesis
church is called
2.
Genesis 2, the Church of Health and Healing. Yeah. And so because he runs a church and because he asks for donations and because he makes it very, very clear that this is not a commercial transaction, that these are sacramental provisions that are required by donation only, he's basically skirting the FDA, the FTC, he's skirting any sort of, you know, legal action because he's saying, I'm not selling these to people.
Yeah, he's trying to anyway.
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to, but I think they're on to him. They've been slapping him on the wrist. And, you know, now he's in Mexico, but like, come on, people are still buying this to the extent that the FDA has been alerted enough times that they have to be like, come on, people, don't drink bleach.
So you know what his story is?
What's his story?
So Jim Humble, he's a former Scientologist.
Yep,
sure.
Right? And he claims that he's a billion-year-old god from the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yes.
Cool.
That is Hey, it so that checks that out, Steve. It actually checks out because the Andromeda Galaxy, I looked it up once, is about 10 billion years old. So the 1 billion year old age is totally, totally possible
it makes sense,
in that context.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like his photoshopped picture in front of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I totally believe him.
Do you? There's something about a man in a white suit.
Yeah, he looks like a billion-year-old god. Totally exudes that, right?
So if he's a god, though, why would he need bleach to heal people? I mean, wouldn't he be able to do that with his fingers?
Are you questioning a billion-year-old god, Jay?
I'm sorry.
My gosh, you are arrogant, man.
Yeah,
I guess
arrogant. I guess I got to rethink this one.
So is this, I mean, we've
Are
had this conversation.
Are you a god?
Say yes.
Here's a tip. When someone asks you if you're a god, say yes.
I always do.
We've had this conversation so many times before where, you know, and we always end up with the same answer, which is ultimately it doesn't matter. But like, is this guy like not well, or is he like a full on, I mean, he's a charlatan either way. But does he truly believe this shit?
Right. How much of this is fraud, fool versus fraud?
Yeah, you never know. You never know. But this sounds like a con to me. That's my opinion.
It sounds like a con to me, too, for sure.
Especially when you are charging people $450. I'm sorry, charging. Asking donations of $450 per person.
Yeah, it's a little calculating.
To partake in this. That screams huckster.
But I just don't get, like, what is his... I mean, I guess his end game is money, but, like, he's killing people. Like, he's killed a few people at this point. Like, he needs to kind of change his methods.
Yeah, if you're
going to
sell snake oil, come up with something benign at least.
Exactly. And maybe make it like taste good, something like you feel good after you take it. Like, not
miracle
bleach.
Kool-Aid.
Yeah. No, after Peter Popoff was busted by Randy for, you know, scamming people with hot readings, cold readings, and everything else, he turned around and started selling water. You know, holy water or something to that effect, you know, but as far as I know, Popoff hasn't poisoned anybody with his, you know, water sales.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike this guy.
Yeah, why bleach?
Yeah.
Oh, this is crazy.
It's horrible.
All right, Carol, let me ask you another question.
Yep.
Do you feed your dog grain-free dog food?
No.
Good.
I feed my dog a dog food. This is so ridiculous. It's a company where you like write in all their things like their weight and their age and kind of the flavor profile that they seem to go crazy for. And then if they have any sort of, does he have a weak stomach or like itchy skin and stuff like that. And then they like formulate dog food for him.
Mm-hmm. It's like a boutique.
Yeah, it's like, you know, because he needs small kibble because he's a little guy, but he needs elderly. He needs senior formula because he's 8 years old now and stuff. And then they just mail it to my house. But it has grain in it, I think.
So here's another FDA notice, right?
Oh.
This one's a little bit less clear
In
terms of the data, right? And so the FDA is pretty confident you shouldn't be drinking bleach. This is more of a... There's a little signal here, a little concern. We don't know what's really going on yet, but you should know about this. So there is a grain-free dog food fad going on. If you walk in, any of you guys, you know, we all have pets, you walk into the Petco or whatever, there's like a ton of grain-free dog food and cat food now right there. What's going on with this? Why? Where did this come from? So the idea is it's part of this whole clean eating natural, appeal to nature food woo that exists in the human market, just extended now to our pets. So the idea is this is one of the justifications for it. Well, dogs are basically wolves, right? Mm-hmm.
That's
and
correct.
Wolves are obligate carnivores.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we feeding them grains? You know, corn, wheat, whatever.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
So it's not healthy. So if you want to feed them an optimal diet, you should, you know, be feeding them something with meat. So every statement in there is incorrect, in that, you know, dogs were separated from wild, you know, wolves about 15,000 to 40,000 years ago, and dogs are not obligate carnivores. They are omnivores. They have adapted their diet. They have adapted to basically live off the scraps of human civilization. They're not wolves, even though technically they are, but they're not, you know, in terms of their diet. So there's no, so the dog food's been formulated because it's good for dogs, right? It's fine. dogs need carbohydrates. They need plant-based food and calories as well as protein.
Dog food, somebody's not just like cooking that up in their basement. There's like tons of like scientists that have worked really hard to make sure that the dog food is safe, that dogs don't die on it, that it like promotes health and prolongs life and keeps their joints healthy. Like they're actually, they need your dog to do well. So you keep buying their dog food. Like
they don't want your
big
dog
conspiracy.
To die. Yeah. So, you know, not that there aren't problems. There have been some problems with dog food ingredients sourced from China, for example, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And some dogs can be sensitive to some of the contents, the ingredients in regular dog food. So, but if your dog has an allergy or just doesn't tolerate the regular dog food, you may need to go to different specialty food. But that's really an exception. Most dogs do perfectly fine with regular dog food, and there's no issue. The grain-free thing is just a food fad, it's just a clean eating food nonsense.
Do you think it comes partially though from, I mean, I'm trying to kind of understand the mindset, and the one mindset that I could kind of understand if somebody made this argument online and I was like, oh, okay, we could have a conversation about this, would be that like, as a society, we have chosen to subsidize corn in a way that is like not amazing. And so we end up with all this extra corn that's really cheap, and we just put it in everything. So like so much processed food that people eat is corn based, right?
Yeah.
And so like, are we putting too much corn in our dog's food that like they shouldn't be eating? Is it healthy for them to eat that much corn, for example? But wait, is corn a grain?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. So like I could see from that kind of argument, like maybe I don't want as much, I don't want corn in my dog food, or I don't want as much of it as probably it would be cost effective to put in as filler. But we have a tendency then to go like, so we should be grain free.
Yeah.
And have but zero corn.
But there's no evidence to support the notion that the regular foods are not perfectly fine. So a lot of the grain-free formulas, the thing is, they're not like they're 100% meat protein. They replace the grain with other plant-based carbohydrates. So like peas, lentils, and potatoes are the most common.
Yeah.
So like the argument about the obligate carnivore, which is not true, doesn't even hold, for most of the grain-free formulas. They're just replacing grains with other kinds of vegetables. So this is why we're talking about this. So that the FDA put out a warning that there has been an increase in the reporting of dilated cardiomyopathy in dogs.
Aww.
DCM, right? Now, some breeds are predisposed to DCM. In fact, a friend of ours, I don't know if Larry's dog is still alive, but a friend of ours has one of the breeds that's predisposed to this, and they're in the process of dying from it right now.
That's sad.
It's usually the bigger dogs. They get this dilated cardiomyopathy. So, but there's been this huge uptick in reporting. And the question is, what is the cause of that? It could just all be a reporting bias, right? Just that people are reporting it because they're hearing about it, And once the initial warnings went out, then of course that's going to provoke a whole bunch of reporting. So we don't really know if there's been an increase, but vets are seeing more of it as well. There's also a case series by a vet who said, yep, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing more cases of dilated cardiomyopathy. We're seeing it in dog breeds that don't normally get it. And it's not just the grain-free diets that it seems to be correlating with. It's correlating with what they're calling the BEG diets, boutique, exotic, and grain-free.
Oh, gosh.
I'm seeing this, people who are feeding their dogs like venison and kangaroo.
Yeah, exactly.
They just pay out the there's a place in LA called, no lie, there's a place called Just Food for Dogs, and it's like a chef's kitchen, and it looks like a restaurant for people. And all they sell is dog food.
Right.
And you go there and get like premium.
And people are starving.
Worst meal ever.
People want to like spend an amazing amount of money to give their dog super high quality food. I'm fine with it. If they want to do it because, the food is available, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's more of just the misinformation.
But yeah, it's like make sure that it's healthy at least and that your dog is getting the nutrition. This reminds me of when people tried to feed cats vegan and then their cats all went blind.
Yeah.
Because they have to eat meat.
So the concern is that the grain-free formulas are not as good, for the dogs as the traditional ones. generally speaking. And
but are they?
Well, we don't know. So this is what the FDA's warning is. Like, there's this signal, right? We're getting these reports. You know, vets are reporting this increase in dilated cardiomyopathy. It seems to correlate with these BEG diets, you know, the boutique exotic or grain-free diets, but we don't know yet. So we need to actually do some research to see what's actually going on here. So at present, it's unknown if it really is a risk or not. But the FDA put the warning out because the initial reports are coming in. But the real issue is that there's no reason to switch your dog to a grain-free diet just on the basis of thinking that it's more natural for them or it's better for them inherently. Now, some people have switched over to a grain-free diet because their dog has allergies or just doesn't tolerate the regular formulas, and they're looking for something else that they can tolerate better, and that's fine. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the fad of grain-free as sort of clean eating for dogs or natural appeal to nature. Sort of, it's like the paleo diet for dogs, basically, that is dramatically increasing recently. Again, it's like overtaken the pet food stores in my experience. And there's no theoretical basis for it. And if this risk pans out, it could be that we are causing health problems in pets by needlessly switching to something based upon this dubious notion that dogs should be eating like wolves, which is not true. It's just simply not true. So don't believe the appeal to nature hype nonsense. You know, if your dog is tolerating regular food, then it's fine for them. There's no particular reason to switch over to some exotic diet. There's no reason to switch over to a grain-free diet if your dog is tolerating the regular food fine. And you know, we'll probably know in a couple of years if, you know, when they do their epidemiological research, you know, if this is a real signal that we're seeing here. Right now, it's just a hypothesis, really, but we shall see. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
The Great Courses Plus is priceless. It's a priceless source of knowledge that you can get in just about any field that exists. It's a streaming service, so don't get confused, because nobody's going to be, you know, coming to your front door talking to you. It's going to be on your phone. It's going to be on the internet. Basically, any device that can stream the internet, right? And the great thing is there are thousands, guys, thousands of lectures waiting for you right now, things that you want to learn about. You can explore everything from the chances of life on Mars to constitutional law to the French language and the psychology of performance.
This week, we're covering the origin and evolution of Earth, from the Big Bang to the future of human existence. And yeah, this is got a lot of detail to it. I mean, they go back billions of years and they talk about the precursors that were required to create the Earth as it is today. They talk about mineralogy and a new view of Earth, the origin and evolution of the early universe, the birth of the solar system, and then the birth of the terrestrial planets. And then they keep going into something called the Big Thwack. What was that? I don't know. Well, actually, I do have an idea, but you may need to listen to find out.
So start learning with The Great Courses Plus today. They're offering SGU listeners an all-access trial free when you sign up through our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Bob. So terraforming Mars is back in the news. This is an idea that won't die, but maybe it should. What do you think?
It won't die. People have been talking about it for over a century, Steve, long before Musk said he wants to nuke it. So yeah, so we're reading up on some of the latest thinking of terraforming, and I want to lead off with basically the idea that Mars is nasty, probably nastier than you think. You know, we always think of Mars as plan B for Earth, right? Yeah. It's the go-to planet that we could migrate to if things get really bad, or we make it really bad, which is more likely. But Mars is essentially as friendly to life as the moon is, and the moon is not friendly at all either. And Mars has an atmosphere almost entirely of carbon dioxide. The atmospheric density is 1/100 of Earth's, super thin atmosphere. So that means that any water on the surface trapped in the polar caps or permafrost would quickly evaporate. So think of the driest spot on Earth, the driest. Mars is 1,000 times drier. And that's just hilarious because I don't know. Dry. But Jay's laughing anyway.
I'm laughing because of what happened in my head when you said, think of the driest place on Earth.
Oh, boy.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's just way too easy. So, plus, don't forget, there's Arctic temperatures at night. The winters are insanely cold. And there's constant UV and cosmic radiation bombardment. And with hardly no magnetosphere at all to talk about, that's bad. And then on top of all of that, you've got a soil chemistry that essentially seems to be designed or optimized to break down organic molecules. So not a great place. So now if you don't want a fully engineered kind of artificial habitat to live in, you want to walk around in like without a spacesuit, right? Which is like the dream of terraforming, right? So how feasible is that? And superficially, it seems plausible, right? Just melt the water at the poles in the permafrost, release the carbon dioxide that's in the ice caps and the crust, and then this should thicken the atmosphere enough to allow for liquid water and start the greenhouse effect, warming things up. Blue skies on Mars, right?
Simple.
No. If you look back to just last year, NASA did a study and really shot some huge, huge holes in that whole idea. Real briefly, this study looked at a lot of the data that we've gathered for the past 2 decades from rovers and spacecraft studying Mars, observing Mars, and they created essentially an inventory of Mars for things like how much CO2 is stored there. And CO2 really is the only real viable greenhouse gas that's available there. Nothing else really packs any greenhouse wallop like CO2. But also water, how much water, and anything else that could be released on Mars now into the thin atmosphere to help it out. And the bottom line, or one of the bottom lines, is that releasing all of that would triple atmospheric pressure. And that sounds pretty good. Wow, 300%, blah. But no, that's only a 50th of what we would need to walk around without a suit. So the main bottom line is that there's just not enough material on Mars to provide even a minimal atmosphere, let alone one that's good for colonization. It just the material is not there. And this is with current technology. So their recommendation in the study was, you know, we can't really do it now or the near future. We're going to have to wait for some really dramatic new technologies to even make this possible and cost effective in any way. So then you start thinking, well, what other options are there besides these, you know, lame artificial tiny habitats or waiting for this future, this far future tech to terraform Mars? What is there anything else? What other options are there? And today, just today, Steve's like, check this out. So I checked out this link about an interesting idea called MATT, M-A-T-T, which stands for Mars Terraformer Transfer. And this is from a group of people, mysterious group of people called the Lake Matthew Team. I couldn't find out too much about the team itself, but I wasn't focusing on the team. I was focusing on their idea. And their idea is to essentially terraform a tiny part of Mars. Their recent press release said terraformation, that's what they call it, terraformation need not engineer an entire planetary surface. A city region is adequate for inhabitation, and Matt hits the mark. Inhabitation. Okay. So their plan starts with what they call a Shepard satellite. This is very, you know, a special device to steer an asteroid or other similar celestial body into the red planet, creating a huge crater, say a 9-kilometer crater, and immensely heating the Martian bedrock. That's the critical part right there. Everything kind of stems from that. So the end result is essentially an energy storage system that colonists can tap into and use for decades or centuries or possibly even longer than that. So now if you imagine the immense kinetic energy an asteroid imparts onto a planet, I mean, you convert a lot of mass and a huge velocity. That translates into an amazing amount of kinetic energy. And that impact would transfer that heat, a lot of the heat that's generated, to the actual bedrock of Mars. And it's like we're talking many terajoules worth, trillions of joules. And the result is what they call an Omaha crater. Hopefully that's obvious to you. That's after the D-Day beachhead. That the Omaha crater could then offer what they claim is the critical resources that colonists can use to live off of, essentially. The first one, primarily, you've got water. Some of the cryosphere, which is the frozen part of the frozen water in a planet, the frozen water of that specific part of Mars specifically, some of that will melt and collect at the bottom. If the post-impact altitude is low enough, and that it would be designed to hit the best part of Mars and create a deep enough crater so that the low point would be low enough that liquid water would persist, because we know it would essentially evaporate on the surface. But if it's deep enough and there's enough atmospheric pressure above it, then it would persist if the temperature doesn't get too hot. And they claim that this water could persist for thousands of years. Because of the heat that was imparted to the bedrock and the heat that would stay there for quite some time. Now, but it's not just the heat that's in the bedrock. The crater itself would be used in their plan. The bedrock under the crater would offer a range of temperatures and elevations. If you could imagine this deep, wide crater, you'd have lots of areas that would be at different altitudes, and they would have different temperatures based on, you know, where they were in relation to, you know, where most of the energy was transferred. And you could use those different temperatures and elevations. You can use them as kind of for energy and resource extraction, and also as settlements. Settlements would actually be in the crater itself that the colonists would live on. Now, their website gives an interesting description and an image of a minimal facility layout in an Omaha crater like this. So they say something like, in the crater, custom mat depressions have been selected for their size, temperature, and elevation. So, for example, Depression 29 contains a lake. Depression 30 contains subaqueous domes for hab and greenhouse. And Depression 31 houses a spaceport, and 32 contains a brine reservoir. So you've got all these various areas that would be all linked together into this sort of a facility in the crater itself. So for things like heat and power, then, how would that work? So in this Omaha crater, they contend that, say it's the winter months and photovoltaics aren't working very much. Mars is farther away than the Earth, and when Mars is at its most distant, photovoltaics aren't very helpful. Heat can be supplied using water pipes, using them as heat exchangers, and that's only just one option to get heat to the people or the various areas of these facilities. For example, they say that a 300-meter dome would use a 10-horsepower pump. Or 7 kilowatts, apparently. And that's all it would need to be able to transfer and keep a dome that big hot enough for people to live in, for example. And they said that if you did not have a crater that was already kind of preheated, if you would, that it would take megawatts to heat a facility of that size. And they go into detail about things like growing plants in the crater, ultimately, and using waste oxygen from some of the industries that would be in the crater, and pumping that in and creating a local ozone layer to protect it and other life down there. So they kind of relate all the different things that can be done to use this crater and the heat that was imparted to it as a resource that colonists and industries can use to survive on Mars, without having to create a tiny, say, 1,000 cubic foot habitat. This could be something like on the order of 1,000,000 cubic foot habitat, much bigger than any previous proposals, and also not having to terraform the entirety of Mars, which, as we know from my previous discussion, is not really feasible with modern technology. So I think it's interesting. I was kind of only just scratching the surface today with my research, but I think it's something that seems interesting, seems plausible from what I could tell with the research I've done. But I definitely want to dig a little deeper and see, you know, how, you know, what other people are saying about this once they really dig into the nitty gritty details.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like one of those ideas that needs to be vetted. You know, the numbers have to be checked out by physicists, et cetera. But I never thought of that. The idea that just smacking something really big and fast into Mars would heat the kinetic energy alone would heat the ground for thousands of years, they're saying.
Cool.
And that could be a massive, just the heat itself would be a huge resource to have on Mars. So, but yeah, the other half of the story is the consensus is pretty clear now that there are simply not enough volatiles on Mars itself to do any significant terraforming.
That's a big takeaway.
We'd have to import an atmosphere, basically. Mm-hmm. And The only plausible way to do that with our current technology would be to steer comets into it. And I was trying to find out, like, all right, so what would it take? How many comets would you have to steer into Mars? I heard different numbers. I heard thousands and I heard millions.
Right. Which one you know? Is it?
I bet you it depends on, of course, how big those volatiles are, the comets are, and what do they actually contain. And then it's like, well, how much do we have in our solar system? There's only about 6,000 or so known comets in the solar system. But there's not including the Oort cloud. There are trillions in the Oort cloud. There are 6,000 that we've discovered in the inner solar system.
All right, all right, fair enough.
There's trillions in the Oort cloud.
Yeah, which is a light year away. So
a light year away. That's not happening anytime. That's it would take us a long time to get there, and a long time for the comet to send the comet back into Mars. So that's not feasible anytime soon. So we're basically talking about there's thousands, you know, that are around. But asteroids probably have more water in them collectively than the comets do. And, you know, you wonder if you could, like, could we just harvest huge chunks of Ceres, you know, for example, which is basically a ball of ice, and somehow get that to Mars? I don't know. Just sort of fling it, you know, fling big chunks of ice at Mars.
Fling!
Yeah, I don't know. So we got to do something like that, or figure out some way to transport a lot of the atmosphere from Venus over to Mars.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
There is a board game, an excellent board game, I might say. We reviewed it called Terraforming Mars. That's the name of the game.
Oh, wow.
Multiple award winner. It's one of the highest rated games out there if you go to the websites. And one of the things you can do, because you're in charge of being, you're in a company in the year 2400, your job is to terraform Mars. And whoever does it to the highest efficiency is the winner. One of the things you do is, you steer comets into Mars and you get big bonus points if you're able to use your resources to do that. So,
yeah. But cool. The other lesson here is do not nuke Mars. That would do nothing.
Yes. Right?
That's what Elon Musk, he proposed that idea a few years ago. He's sort of bringing it up again. Don't know if he's serious. Like, we don't even know if the guy's serious, but he tweeted about it again. Apparently they have a t-shirt now. But that would do nothing. You know, that's not going to help. We have to crash shit into it, asteroids and comets.
Or just throw one good-sized asteroid into it and just live off the heat.
Imagine if we could somehow figure out a way to get Ceres itself, which is the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. It's basically a dwarf planet.
To
crash that into Mars in its entirety. And then we get Mars 2.0, which will be bigger and have all that kinetic energy, and it'll have all the volatiles, all the water and everything. Wonder what the end result of that would be like.
You think its orbit would change?
Yeah, just think of that. It depends how it hits it. Basically, it will definitely change no matter what, just by how much.
Yeah. Anyway, that's not happening either.
Right. Think of what
else
isn't
happening.
Right, and I would say just the two caveats here: before we terraform Mars, we need to make absolutely sure there's no life there, and two, no one serious is saying that this is a plan for what we do if we destroy our own environment. That's
right,
dumb.
Right.
It's just stupid. That's not the argument. No matter what we do to Earth, it would be easier to fix our own environment than to try to terraform Mars. No matter what, we can't mess up the Earth so much that it's still not much better than any attempt at terraforming Mars.
Like, my response to that is don't even go there.
Yeah, it's just not the point. But it's more the idea of it'd be nice if we weren't all on one planet in case something really big smacks into the Earth. Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses, boys?
Yeah, that is a amplified and extended version of the Darth Vader scream in the end of episode 3 when he's launched off the table like Frankenstein's monster.
Oh, my God.
Can I ask you this, Jay? Is it something slowed down?
No.
Is it something extended?
Is it something sped up?
Isn't that something you're supposed to say when someone kicks a goal in World Cup soccer?
No.
All right, so Nicholas Vasilakis.
Nicholas V.
Nicholas V. Thank you, Evan. You know, I'm so sorry to every single person out there. Just bear with me. You know. Hi, Jay. This week's noisy made me think of how you can set up two separate speakers playing the same frequency in phase and create peaks and troughs of sound, constructive and destructive interference. As you move your head or microphone through the room, you find loud and quiet spots of fun physics demonstration. Nicholas, that is incorrect, but it is a very astute guess. For those of you who are sonically inclined, that is a very smart guess. Another listener named Scott Peterson wrote in, he says, is this week's noise a vibrating metal plate? It reminds me of the vibrating metal discs with small grains of sand that create the patterns, something called a Chladni plate. Thanks always. One day I will win. Yes, you will, Scott. Keep guessing. That one is incorrect. Another listener guest named Visto Tutti said this week's noisy is a room test tone as used by audio technicians to find the resonant frequency of a space. That is not correct. He also called me an unbelievable tricky bastard.
Mm-hmm.
You sure that was him?
Yes.
Okay.
Why, was it you?
You just never know.
This is another quick guess, Thomas. Ron Zinsky said it sounds like the male tone of a Tibetan singing bowl.
Mm.
It's a little similar. I'm familiar with that sound. If you haven't heard of that, look it up. A Tibetan singing bowl. It's hit with a metal mallet or stroked with a metal mallet.
Yeah, yeah.
They could be very pretty.
I've seen people playing those, yeah.
Jared Popowski wrote, hi, Jay. My friend got me into SGU a few weeks ago. I love the podcast, and this is my first time writing in. This week's noisy sounds like a trombone playing the note D, perhaps with a mute in its bell, question mark. Judging by how long the note goes for, I feel like the trombone player, if that's what it is making the sound, might be circular breathing, a technique that allows you to breathe and play at the same time. Cheers, Jared. Okay, so Jared, you are 100% correct.
Whoa.
Freakishly correct. This is what Matt wrote. He said, in the Peanuts cartoon, all adults were voiced by a trombonist with a harmon or plunger mute. The player would quickly manipulate the whole of the mute to get the famous wah-wah sound. My noisy is me playing a D above middle C with a harmon mute, but instead of moving my hand quickly, I'm moving very slowly. You can hear all the harmonics of the trombone build up and back down. It is completely analog. It's a completely analog sound. It hasn't been mechanically manipulated other than recording it with my crappy smartphone mic. I'm really glad you've gone full time. I've been listening since the early days, Matt Wright. And he's also a patron. He's a biomorph.
Cool.
Thank you so much for sending that in, Matt. For Matt, were you using circular breathing in order to play that note? And if, for those of you who don't know what circular breathing is, it's a technique used by people who use wind instruments.
Didgeridoo.
To be able to play a continuous note. What they end up having to do is they have to fill their mouth with air and then close off their throat so they can, not close their throat, but close off the air in their mouth from their nasal cavity so they can inhale, get more air in, and then continue playing. I actually had to learn how to do this when I learned how to play the Hoosiewatzer, you know, the didgeridoo. Steve?
Yeah.
Did you learn circular breathing with your didgeridoo playing?
A little bit. I never really got good at it. You know, it's funny.
I got good at it.
If you didn't know what a didgeridoo was, you would probably think that was a made-up name.
Right?
I know. It just totally sounds like a Hoosiewatzer. It totally sounds like it.
Yeah.
Very cool. I have a new noisy for this week. Now, my question for you is, how is this sound produced?
All aboard! All aboard! Clear the track!
How is that sound produced?
Jeez, what is that? The train to hell? Is that
Wasn't that
devil?
Sent in by Justin Fisher? Apparently, Justin is, I don't know, Ev, you're going to have to email him if you want to know before next week. Now, Steve, there's a few more things. One of them is we will be appearing in Australia.
Naked? Oh, yeah.
No, in the picture with me. We will be in Australia. We will be in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
These are conferences you're going to want to go to.
Yes.
Yeah, you can go to theskepticsguide.org and go to our events page, and all the details of these conferences that we will be at will be listed there for you. And, man, if you're in New Zealand or Australia, please come and see us because we're totally looking forward to these conferences. We're going to have such a great time. And it's a ton of hard work, but we really are looking forward to it. Now, something a little bit less temporally compromised, meaning it's happening much sooner, is that our friend George Robb is having what he calls a house-type concert. And this is happening in Dedham, Massachusetts on Sunday, September 8th, which is what, like the week after Dragon Con.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, Now, these events are incredibly cool. George has done this. I've seen George do these types of events. It's him with a guitar, and that's it. And he usually likes to take questions from the audience, and it's a lot of fun, and he tells a lot of stories.
It is a lot of fun.
Of course, it is a ton of fun. I mean, I've seen George do this dozens of times at this point and never get tired of it. I love all of George's songs.
Well, he has enough of a repertoire that like you don't get the same show twice, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and George is working on new songs too, which I'm sure he'll probably play some of his new material. So that's on Sunday, September 8th. George will be performing an intimate acoustic concert at the WYND television studio in Dedham, Massachusetts.
How intimate?
He says it's intimate, Bob. You better watch out. It's only 30 minutes out of Boston. It's in South Boston, and there'll only be a limit. There's a limit of 50 seats. That's it. So you got to reserve your seat.
That will sell out.
If you want to reserve a seat, you can email George directly at george@georgetraub.com. And WYND TV is at 502 Sprague Street, Dedham, Massachusetts, and the show will start at 6 p.m.
Cool. So, guys, we have a fun Name That Logical Fallacy. This one is comes from a letter from Ben. And Ben writes, he heads his email to us, Grand Conspiracies and Fake Hair. What do you think those two things have in common, grand conspiracies and fake hair? He says, I've been posting on Steve's blog in the comments section to his post about Jeffrey Epstein's death. My position has been that the banal explanation that suicides, unfortunately, happen in prisons, especially when paired with incompetent or ineffective policies or prison staff, is the most likely explanation for his death, while a grand conspiracy murder plot is unlikely based off the available evidence. As part of this discussion, I referred to the news article from a while ago regarding the analysis of grand conspiracies and how fast they fall apart. And thus, we can say that successful grand conspiracies, which remain concealed over time, are relatively rare. Another commenter argued that this was an expression of the toupee fallacy, that we can't say how rare such conspiracies are because they are, by definition, hidden. So, any thoughts on how to untangle this? Thanks for the years of stimulating, thought-provoking discussions. Thank you, Ben. So, what do you guys think about this? Is that correct? Do you think that is the toupee fallacy? And so, the toupee fallacy, for those who may not know what it is claiming that I always can tell when someone's wearing a toupee, right? And of course, you only know when you think you can tell that someone's wearing a toupee, unless you systematically evaluate 100 or 200 sequential people and check if they're wearing a toupee. You don't know what your false negative rate is, right? You don't know how many toupees you missed. You also need to confirm that the people you think are wearing toupees are actually wearing toupees. So that's the toupee fallacy, because you're missing, at the very least, you're missing the negatives as well as not confirming the positives. So their point is, if a conspiracy is successful and remains completely hidden, we wouldn't know about it. And therefore, we have no idea what the rate of successful conspiracies is. What do you think about that, guys?
I don't disagree. I disagree. It's all about probability with these grand conspiracies. If you look at the odds of so many people, you know, a certain amount of people keeping a conspiracy, then it goes down the longer that grand conspiracy happens and the more people that are involved. So the biggest grand conspiracies that involve lots and lots of people over many decades, like the moon landing hoax, are so highly unlikely that chances are that it's much, much more likely that it doesn't exist, that we did land on the moon, because it never could have lasted that long. So it's about probability, whereas the toupee fallacy really isn't.
It's based on observation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. So they're making a category mistake here. It's not the principle is based on probability, not observation, whereas the toupee fallacy is about observation.
Right.
So if we were saying we know that successful conspiracies are rare because we never see them, that would be the toupee fallacy.
Right.
But if you're saying they must be rare because it would be impossible to sustain one mathematically from just fundamental analysis of how they work, that has absolutely nothing to do with the toupee fallacy. So it completely depends upon what the basis of your argument is. But it is interesting that it is true, although unrelated to our discussion, that we don't know if there are any successful conspiracies out there. because
conspiracies,
by definition,
conspiracies,
they are successful,
right.
But they would have to be completely successful, so successful that there aren't conspiracy theories about them, and they never eventually come to light. So, but you can sort of nibble around the edges of that claim in other ways. Are there anomalies that require explanation that we never explain, you know? But then even then, so you'd have to say that, well, what if the conspiracies are so successful that you're not even aware there's anything awry?
Yeah, it's lurking in the background. You can't even see it. You have no means of detecting it. How could you even know it's existence?
Yeah, but that's
existence.
That drives all conspiracy theorists, though. Like, it's so devilishly well planned, like the Illuminati, that you'll never be able to find a clue about them.
No, but that's not true, Jay. So the format of a grand conspiracy is that the conspirators are devilishly clever on the one hand, but they're simultaneously so dumb that they completely tip their hand to the conspiracy theorists who can see that it's really going on. So they always make really stupid mistakes while simultaneously carrying off this impossible conspiracy, because otherwise the conspiracy theorists wouldn't know about it, right? So like that's like the flag waving in the wind, right, for the moon landing hoax conspiracy theory. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, they pulled off this whole theory, and then somebody opened a door and let the breeze in to blow the flag that's supposed to be on the moon. Yeah, that's what happened, Guy. You're right. But that's literally what they think.
Brilliant.
But what we're talking about is a hypothetical conspiracy that's so successful that nobody thinks even knows that it exists or thinks about it. But that, of course, is an unfalsifiable hypothesis, right? You're saying, what if there is something that exists that's undetectable by definition? It's like, okay, well, you're right. We don't know what the rate of that is, because that's unfalsifiable. We can't know by definition. But so what? Yeah. You know, but you still have what the incidence could be zero. You know, or they could be happening all the time.
Dimensional shifting aliens might be observing us right now. How would you know?
But it's also important to recognize that that's never what we're talking about, right? When we're talking about conspiracy theories, right? And I just pointed out one critical difference. Like the grand conspiracy theory has a certain structure to it that is different than a hypothetical perfect conspiracy that nobody detects. And the thing is, I'm sure that conspiracies have gone undetected. The only question is how big. Three people, sure. One corporation getting away with doing something sleazy, sure. You know, governments hiding their bad stuff, whatever, of course. But a grand conspiracy, something that would require hundreds or thousands of people or multiple institutions or even international over generations, I mean, that kind of thing, no. That's inherently implausible. And, you know, the thing is, eventually that would have to come to light somehow. At least.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, I would bet everything I own that there is no grand conspiracy in effect right now at that level.
Right.
I mean, it's just so implausible because it goes against human psychology. And when you've got – sure, there are people and handfuls of people or even dozens of people that could go against human psychology in a lot of ways. But when you start having hundreds of people or thousands of people, someone's going to break. Someone's going to leak it. Someone's going to try to capitalize on it. Human psychology is just too powerful for so many people to go against it for so long.
You're asking a level of control of people that's practically impossible to contain, that for nothing to leak accidentally or otherwise. It statistically it.
But
just
I would add one caveat to that. We're assuming an open society.
Yeah.
I if you had a in North Korea, if you have a totalitarian government that has that level of control, everything's a conspiracy, right? I mean, they're. The people at the small, you know, cabal of people at the top are running everything and are hiding information from the general population, but they have a totalitarian government. So that's what it takes, though. But what most grand conspiracies essentially are saying, that we're living in a totalitarian country, but don't know it. that our democracy, our freedom of the press is all an illusion. It's all part of the conspiracy. That it's actually even more totalitarian than the likes of North Korea because we don't even know it. That's how much control they have over the press and over.
Oh, great.
They're actually hiding the fact that it is a totalitarian government. Yeah. So again, it comes around to, again, the unfalsifiable hypothesis.
It's a fun thing to think about, but I really feel sorry for people who slip into that hole. You know, like it's terrifying to think that there are people that are inside of that and spending all of
it's
their
time. It is a trap.
It's a mega filter, right, Evan? It's all consuming. It's a mega filter on your entire perception on reality. I mean, these are delusional people, I think.
Functional, yeah. Like we know people, and there are people absolutely who believe the world is flat. What gets you to that point? It's the conspiracy thinking, right? You have to your thinking gets turned in on itself to such a pathological degree that you could believe anything. This is part of the human condition that we have to understand and we have to work against. Otherwise, you can fall into it. It's just a flaw in how our brains process information.
And but even more importantly, Evan, you mentioned the Matrix. Just found out hot off the presses, Matrix 4 officially a go with Keanu Reeves, Carrie-Anne Moss, and Lana Wachowski.
Oh my God.
Just saying, kids.
All right, well, we won't get into that. That's our discussion for another, for a different program altogether.
Yeah.
Jay, perhaps Alpha Quadrant 6. Oh, wait, we're out of time.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have an interesting theme this week. The theme is mad scientists.
What?
Interesting.
These are three real-life mad scientists, although one is fake. So two of these are real and one fake mad scientist. Oh, you'll understand. Ready?
Yes.
All right. Listen to this. Jose Delgado, a Yale physiologist, invented a stimosiever, a radio-controlled implant he placed in the brains of animals and ultimately people to remotely control their emotions and physical movements. Item number two, Soviet biologist Ilya Ivanov successfully created a human-chimp hybrid, although the infant only lived for 3 weeks. And item number three, Russian physician Sergei Brukhonenko kept a decapitated dog's head alive and awake with extracorporeal blood perfusion. Kara, go first.
Okay, I have a hunch on this, so I want to like just go with my gut, which is maybe going to screw me, but... The stimosiever from a Yale physiologist, which was a radio-controlled implant that he tried in people to remotely control their emotions and physical movements. I have no idea. That's the one where I'm like, I don't know. Could be. What year was this? The stimosiever. The word sounds fake, which makes me think it's probably real. The one that I'm not liking is the human-chimp hybrid. The one that I really am liking is the decapitated dog's head, because I know that there have been experiments with a decapitated dog's head where it was like blood vessels and nerves, or maybe it was just blood vessels. And like the dog was like blinking its eyes and like smacking its lips and stuff. I don't think it stayed awake for alive for a very long time, but it stayed alive after it was severed from the head, like a chicken's head does. And so that one I think is science, even though I don't know if this is the guy or if I'm kind of making this up, but I think that one's science. But the one that bothers me is the human chimp hybrid. 3 weeks? How, like, what does this even mean, a human-chimp hybrid? Like, a human and a chimp mated? Or, like, they implanted an egg with sperm from the other one? I don't think that's possible. I think it would definitely have spontaneously aborted. We have a different number of chromosomes. I just don't see it happening. I could see grafting, like, a chimp's arm onto a human. But to me, that's not a human-chimp hybrid. That's cheap. So I think I'm going to go with Ilya Ivanov being the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Oh, my sweet God, Steve. What have you done to us tonight? All right, I'll take them in order. Jose Delgado. Of all three of these, this is the one that seems the most believable, that he implanted a stimosiever, It's basically a radio-controlled shock therapy, I guess, the way I'm reading it. Some jerko would do that to people. Okay. I have no reason to doubt that, and that's at least plausible. Now, this one about the Soviet biologist who created the human chimp hybrid. It's a hybrid. What is kind? You know, I agree with Kara. Like, what are we talking? Although the infant only lived for 3 weeks, so you can't breed a human and a chimp. So this had to be genetic engineering, and I just don't see. There's no year on this, so we don't know when this was done. I just can't possibly see how that would work. So that one is highly. I'm not sure about that one on a huge level. And this last one, a Russian physician, Sergei. And he kept a decapitated dog's head alive in a week. I thought I heard they did this to monkeys. Maybe I've heard about this. So it's between the human chimp hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid, like I'm saying, or a decapitated dog's head in a petri dish, like just barking away, you know, just rah, rah, rah,
rah. Petri dish.
Small
it's big petri
small
dish
or a small dog.
Whatever. It's in a bowl of some kind, Bob. I mean, come on. I will go with Kara.
Okay.
It's bold.
Yep.
All right, Evan.
Yeah, this one's really, really tough to swallow. 3 weeks. Ah, crazy. This is the stuff of nightmares, all of these. Yeah, that one struck me as the least likely of these. But they're all disturbing. Let's make no mistake about it. I will also go with Kara. That's just what I'm doing this week because I said so.
And Bob.
Okay, so the decapitated dog's head. Yeah, I researched head transplants.
Yours didn't succeed, right, Bob?
Mine was good. It's never been replicated. So I remember researching it, and I came across something like this. My memory is telling me that it was done and didn't survive long, and they really couldn't, of course, find out or figure out what it was really experiencing. But yeah, it's a nasty bit of work right there. So that one, I think I'm very confident about. The first one is stemosever. What the hell? This only makes sense if think that this was many, many decades ago that this happened. Because getting to the point where you even think, yes, I am ready for to implant this to control motions and physical movements. We're so far from that at this point. Physical movements. Imagine how complicated that would be with just one device in your brain. So this must have been some deluded punk from Yale from many, many decades ago. That's the only way I can make sense of that. The second one, first off, Kara was right. What kind of hybrid? You know, you're not going to mate. And if it's some sort of transplant, or I was thinking, you know, some chimp genes. But then you're not a hybrid. You're kind of a chimera, right? Is that how you pronounce that word?
Mm-hmm.
So that one, yeah, this one is much more egregious than the other one. So I'll definitely say that Kara, Evan, and Jay is going with Bob for this one.
Wow. Just like Bob. That.
Because I thought of it before anybody said anything. Well, you probably were thinking the same thing. But
that's very confident for when Steve sweeps us.
Yeah, right.
So let's take these in order. Jose Delgado, a Yale physiologist, invented the stemosever, a radio-controlled implant he placed in the brains of animals and ultimately people to remotely control their emotions and physical movements. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Yay! Nice.
And stemosever.
Bob, he did this and it worked.
Oh, bullshit. I call
radio
bullshit.
Radio-controlled implants?
Yeah, it totally worked.
What was he control? I mean, I know it says to remotely control their emotions and physical movements.
He did.
Movements. Like, yeah, but like, what was he actually doing? Was he like making their arms jump around and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, he could make them move. If he put the leads in the motor cortex, he could.
Yeah.
He couldn't control them like a puppet because they didn't have that exquisite control.
What I was thinking.
But he can make them. He can control their physical movements. He can make them move an arm or move a leg or stop moving. In fact, he did. He implanted one of these into a bull. This was a gimmicky thing that he did, and then he got into the ring with them, and then the bull charged at him, and he hit the button on his radio controller and stopped the bull in his tracks.
On the stemosever.
With the stemosever, because he put the it stimulated and it was a receiver because it also sent EEG information back to him.
When was this done? What year?
all through radio transmissions, like in the 30s.
Yeah, okay. I'm still impressive that they could have pulled that off.
This was like 30s. before modern ethical standards.
Think?
Before the Helsinki Accords. Yeah, so, but this guy, you know, at the time was legit, you know, legit researcher. And then, you know, he did it in human patients. He would stick electrodes in different parts of their brain and like the thalamus, and they would go through like every emotion. Like they would feel fear or anger or contentment or euphoria or whatever.
Where did this guy find people to do this?
He's probably already doing brain surgery on them, right?
No, he really wasn't a surgeon. He was more a physiologist. He also invented an early version of what would evolve into a cardiac pacemaker. So this is, you know, along the same lines.
Guys, here's a little cool thing I remember reading a while back where they had identified, doing brain surgery, they identified like basically the area of the brain that mediates humor, the appreciation of humor. so when they stimulated it, the person under the knife was like laughing at everything that happened, and she'd say stuff like, "Ha ha, you guys are standing there so funny. This is just so hilarious. Everything was funny. No matter what you did, you were hilarious."
It's like that. It's like the Matrix cartoon, Bob, right? Where they're experimenting on people's brains and like how to interface.
Exactly.
They're laughing and crying.
Right. So the thing is, Steve, one thing I could see stimulating an area and inducing an emotion or a random movement. I mean, how many places would you need to stimulate to run through a suite of emotions? I mean, would you like stimulate all these areas and have them ready to go? Or would it just be like one area? Or it just seems like, oof.
Yeah. So, you know,
scary,
it was the 30s.
You know what the problem was with this technology?
Infection?
Infection. Yeah.
Yeah. Infection. Well, you think?
Yeah.
So. Seems a bit
washed. Just hands, one of right? the many problems.
Also, did he market it as like, "I'm going to cure your depression"? Is that why people were willing to do it?
This was research. I don't think it was not like, on the market. He wasn't a crank. He was a legit physiologist.
No, but that's why I'm saying he was probably working with surgeons.
Yeah, that was his goal.
Surgeons were already doing surgery.
Yes, the goal was to develop this into a treatment for things like depression. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Seizures.
That's what he was saying.
He also did this thing where he did this, you know, in a person, you know, where he did this in a chimpanzee or a monkey, where he basically created a negative feedback loop, so that whenever the animal got excited, it would give them a negative feedback emotion, and then it was able to, over time, they basically avoided that behavior, so they just became really calm.
Ooh,
so he said, we could do this kind of training to stop panic attacks or seizures or whatever. That was kind of the idea. But just the technology.
Oh, great. So let me get this straight. You're having a panic attack, and they zap you to not have the panic attack.
Calm down.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that would help me a lot.
All right, let's go to number two. Soviet biologist Ilya Ivanov successfully created a human-chimp hybrid, although the infant only lived for 3 weeks. You guys all think this one is the fiction. So let me give you a little background. this was, in fact, the area of Ilya Ivanovich's research. She was trying to do this. The question is, did she succeed? So first, she tried to inseminate female chimps with human sperm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, and she progressed to trying to impregnate human females with male chimp sperm.
Uh-oh.
Right?
Okay.
But she never could get it to work. Yep. So this is the fiction.
She tried
to do it. But yeah, the whole, you know, and she did research into hybridizing different species. Like she did different horses and, you know, horses and zebras and things like that. But yeah, I could not get it to work between humans and chimps. And we know now because they have a different number of chromosomes. I don't know if she was aware of that at the time she was doing her research. This was 1898.
I hope she wasn't.
Jeez, 1898.
She established her laboratory. Yeah, so she was doing this after that. So 1901.
Well, when did we even find out about, like, chromosomes?
Genes und Chromosomes.
When was the Mendel experiments? In the 1850s? Or something?
Yeah, but then
we didn't know they were chromosomes. They were like packets of information back then.
Yeah, later, not till later.
Yeah. So there's no way she could have known. That's really interesting.
Right.
She was smart.
Worth a shot back then.
And humans and chimps are very closely related. That would be, you know, they were mm-hmm. as close as horses and donkeys, you know.
Zebras? Oh.
All right. All this means that Russian physician Sergei Brukhonenko kept a decapitated dog's head alive and awake with extracorporeal blood perfusion is science.
Cruel.
Science?
Yeah, man. And evil science.
And you could see the video.
Yeah, science.
Linked to the video.
No.
Video in the show. Yes.
No, thank
and there's
you.
This dog's head
not
on a
interested.
Table.
Yeah, you know, watch this video.
You've
so
seen the video.
Up.
It's a way.
I don't
it's
even
like,
want to watch it.
Well, it's no. really like it's very grainy and black and white, so it doesn't look nearly as graphic as you would think.
It's not in 4K. Screw
no.
that.
It is pretty cool.
Why a pet animal? Why couldn't it be, you know, a warthog or something?
Because they were easy. Well, first of all, warthogs are not. Wait, where was this? In Russia? There are no warthogs in Russia. But second of all, they were easy to get.
How about a bog hog?
Now, this is like to think that there really were mad scientists out there like doing wacky stuff like this. I mean, these are nightmares for everybody.
This guy is credited, Brukhonenko, with advances that were critical to the development of the first heart-lung machine for total body perfusion, you know. This was serious medical research. Yeah, he wasn't just a mad scientist. This was serious medical research, and it did lead to technology that is important and life-saving today. So I know we could look at it and go, oh, my God, he's keeping a dog's head alive. How creepy. It is kind of creepy, but this guy developed real medical technology that is still relevant, still important today. If anyone who's get bypass surgery or whatever gets surgery where you have to put the heart on a heart-lung bypass so that we can operate on it, owes their life partly to this research that we're talking about.
Yeah, and hey, man, if I'm 85 or 90 and a body or a head transplant would work, I'd do it.
Yeah?
I'd do it, sure, better than – what's the alternative? Or die?
Yeah.
Die or head transplant. I'll take head transplant.
I'll take die.
Yeah, wait, but you're the head being transplanted onto the other body, of course, right, Bob?
It's a body transplant.
Oh, by definition.
Right. Of course, that doesn't work. Right. So there's that Italian surgeon who claims that he's going to.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Of course. It can't be done now, but the premise is that it's a viable choice.
And the problem is that you're paralyzed, right? You have to sever the spinal cord and all the nerves.
Okay. I'd still do it.
They haven't fixed that problem yet.
Yeah. It's like, first, let's regenerate spinal cords. Then you can talk to me about a head transplant.
Yeah, that's fine. But, hey, say, you know, I mean, there are scenarios where it's even being a quadriplegic is preferable.
Okay.
Think so?
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
A quadriplegic, and you can't breathe either, so you're on a ventilator. So it's a complicated question, Bob. You can't be flippant about it.
Now, I'm not.
First of all, some people legitimately would rather be dead than that be their quality of life. Quite and that's fine people. If that's what you choose.
Okay.
Whereas other people would choose to be virtually locked in as long as their mind were intact. That's a very individual decision. And until you're like staring down life as a quadriplegic, you shouldn't be flippant about that.
But also, you're right.
I'm serious. That's what my choice would be.
Yeah. You really feel that way?
Test a VR simulator ahead of time or something.
In a heartbeat.
And I feel the opposite. I feel like there's just no way. But again, who knows if I would feel desperate at the time. I think it also depends on how old you are.
So all right, the question is, how well developed is VR technology at this point? That's a very important part of our calculus.
Yep. You know, put me in front of Netflix. I'll be good for a while.
Binge watch.
Oh, my gosh. Right. So, yeah. Steve, how close are we to the next Star Wars movie coming out?
Steve, in the future, this is how corrupt and nasty TV shows are going to get. They're going to fund wacky scientists to start their own mad science lab.
Like a reality TV,
the whole thing.
Yeah.
Running Man, you know?
Yeah, sure. All right, Evan, hit us up with a quote.
Dolphins and monkeys basically could play chess together. Those are brilliant animals. Perry DeAngelis.
That's right. Anniversary 12 yesterday.
Years, 12 years.
Wow.
Guys. Yeah. Gone 12 long years. Jeez.
Wow. Holy crap.
I know. We're starting to get to that point where he's been gone longer than I knew him.
Oof. Wow. That sucks.
But never Not quite, forget. But I think about. I still think about him every day. At least my memory tells me I think about him every day, as best as my recollection allows.
Guys, I don't want to co-opt this because I want to end it on a note with Perry, so I want to come back to it. And I know we're closing up the show, but I lost a good friend this week, and so I wanted to make sure that just in case if anybody was listening who loved Jesse as much as I did, who remembers Jesse being the heart of their high school experience as I did. I miss you every day, and it was really a shock to me and to everybody else. And I'm so sorry I couldn't be there for the funeral, everybody. But Jesse, I love you.
I'm sorry, Kara. Was an unexpected death?
Yeah, it was very unexpected. And it was a guy, you know, I haven't seen in a very long time because he's back in Texas, but he really was the center of everything for my group in high school. He was the glue that bound us together. He was the reason we were all friends. He was the influence for me for why I listened to the music that I listen to still to this day. I mean, just so many amazing memories.
Yeah, there are some people, man, that just are like bigger than life, you know? Like, absolutely. That definitely was Perry. Perry was like
larger than life.
Always the
way.
That had took up all the space in the room, you know, just psychologically, you know what I mean?
In a good way.
In a very good way. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
See you at DragonCon.
Good work, Steve. Yeah, we're off to DragonCon next week. The next episode up is going to be the private show that we recorded at Nexus.
That was fun.
And then the show after that will be the live show that we're recording from DragonCon.
And that will be fun.
2 weeks. And then we'll be back in 3 weeks. All right, guys, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And don't forget, the Great Courses Plus is a priceless source of knowledge in just about any field. The streaming service has thousands of in-depth lectures from reliable professors and experts. I love listening to the Great Courses in my car, or watching on my computer, or just about anywhere. Start learning with the Great Courses Plus today. They're offering our listeners an all-access trial for free when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.